Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce to our speaker today, RCVS Diploma and Specialist in Small Animal Orthopaedics, Stephen Caff. Thank you, Stephen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. So today we're going to do a little bit of an update on osteosarcoma, where over the next, sorry, bear with me a tick, over the next 60 minutes, we're going to discuss a little bit about its biological behavior, how they present to us, a little bit on how we diagnose and stage this, and then we're going to have a look at some of the prognostic indicators or things that might influence the survival times of these dogs, and then finally, we'll discuss a few of the treatment options that we've got available. Now, osteosarcoma, it's one of the most common primary bone tumours in dogs and cats. In fact, it accounts for around 85% of bone tumours in dogs, where 75% of these affect the appendicular skeleton. It's typically located in the metaphysis of long bones, as demonstrated in these radiographs, whilst it's previously been suggested to be more frequent in a near, far, far near location, i.e. the proximal humerus, distal radius, distal femur, proximal tibia, we can see it in just about any location. Now, osteosarcoma, it typically starts in an endosteal location and then expands outwards. The osteolysis progressively destabilizes the bone and ultimately leads to catastrophic failure or fracture. Now, as it's destabilizing the bone, we can understand that this micro cracking of the cortical and trabecular bone will obviously cause a degree of pain. One thing it's easy to forget is that these are space-occupying masses, and as such, the expanding tumor increases the intramedullary pressure of the bone. Now, this will also contribute to pain and ultimately mechanical failure. So one way I tend to think about this is as the tumor expands, it's like a balloon expanding. And ultimately, we can see the balloon will pop. Now, whilst it affects 75% of long bones, we also see it affecting flat bones. And these three radiographs demonstrate the tumor affecting the ilial wing in both the left and the right radiographs on this slide. The changes on the right radiograph are pretty subtle, but if you look carefully at the ilial wing on the right side of the radiograph, you'll see some very subtle periosteal reaction. The central radiograph with the scapula, it's pretty obvious what's going on with the top half of that scapula. So you can see that very large bony reaction. And then on the far left x-ray, again, you can see a degree of periosteal reaction and very subtle bone lysis affecting the ilial wing on the far left. So this is a highly aggressive tumour. And whilst we'll expect to see macrometastatic disease in around 10% of dogs affecting the lungs, 8% to other bones, and around 4% to the lymph nodes, we expect that most dogs will have evidence of this disease by the time they come to us, or they'll at least have micrometastatic disease. So whilst we might not find it when we go hunting, we expect this will be a life-limiting disease for the vast majority of these dogs. Now, when we're looking at this disease, we think what sort of factors might influence the development of this of osteosarcoma? Are there any things that might make dogs more at risk? Now, interestingly, there's one study looking at neutering, and this is a study looking at 683 Rottweilers. Now, whilst it's not very well known to most of the public, you'll find that most Rottweiler breeders are aware of this study. And so certainly when you're discussing neutering, especially with Rottweiler owners, it's worthwhile being aware at least of this study. So this study looked at 683 Rottweilers that were neutered before a year of age, and they found an extraordinarily higher risk of these dogs developing osteosarcoma, so a factor of 3 to 4 times. Now, this was independent of the adult height or body weight, so didn't matter whether these dogs ended up being giant Rottweilers or small Rottweilers, there was a significantly higher risk. Now, this is a study that's not been repeated. It only looked at 683 dogs. They were only Rottweilers. Whether or not this is a factor that influences the development of osteosarcoma in other breeds is an unknown, but certainly if you deal with Rottweiler breeders, it's worthwhile knowing. In people, a mutation of the P53 tumor suppressor gene has been shown to significantly increase the risk of the development of at least high-grade osteosarcoma. Whilst there's been, again, one study looking at in dogs, it's probably a bit of a watch this space at this time. Now, we see potentially a higher incidence or higher incidence of the development of osteosarcoma at fracture sites and potentially where metal implants are. Now, this is a particularly controversial topic, and there's considerable debate regarding whether implant-associated osteosarcoma in dogs actually exists. The question is the osteosarcoma related to increased bone turnover, or is it simply due to a reaction from the implants? Now, it was originally suggested as a reaction to the composition of Slocum TPLO plates, but it's subsequently been demonstrated following TPLO with other bone plates, and it's also been demonstrated following a TTA with titanium implants. Now, I guess ultimately, whilst a true implant-induced osteosarcoma may exist, fracture sites and metaphyseal osteotomies and the metaphysis in general, these are areas of high bone turnover and thus may be predisposed to the development of osteosarcoma anyway. So it's an interesting topic. Whether or not it's really occurring because of an implant is a bit of an unknown again. So this is predominantly a disease of large and giant breed dogs, but around 5% of osteosarcoma cases will present in dogs smaller than 15 kilos. So it's certainly worthwhile remembering that and certainly not excluding that off your differential list when dealing with a small dog. Now, whilst we see the vast majority in large and giant breeds, there's probably a predisposition for the development in some breeds. Now, one study demonstrated the prevalence of osteosarcoma in greyhounds at 6.2%, Rottweilers in 5.3%, and Great Danes in 4.4%. So that's almost 1 in 20 of these dogs are supposed to develop osteosarcoma. Now, that's an extraordinary finding. And it's probably not entirely the case, but what that study does show is that these are high-risk breeds. Most people tend to think osteosarcoma is a disease of older or at least middle-aged dogs, but osteosarcoma, like in people, tends to have a bit of a bimodal presentation. So we see a small peak of dogs present somewhere between 18 and 24 months of age, with the rest presenting somewhere around 7 to 9 years of age, sometimes a bit later. Now, anecdotally, if you've got a young dog that presents with an osteosarcoma, this is bad news. These tumors tend to be very high grade, and often you'll have a macro metastatic disease in these guys at presentation. So these guys invariably present to you with varying degrees of lameness. Now, some of these dogs, like the Great Dane, if we get the first video up, some of these dogs, like this Great Dane, have a fairly low-grade lameness, and this is despite the dog having quite a large distal antibrachial mass. And you can see it as the dog walks back towards us. That's quite a large swelling, and whilst the dog's a little bit lame, it's not too bad at all. We can see these guys present with a pathological fracture as well. So the second video is a video of a mastiff with a fairly severe lameness, and this dog actually has a pathological fracture of the proximal right humerus. So we can see varying different degrees of lameness despite what may or may not be obvious disease. Now, the key finding for me with these guys, regardless of whether they've got an obvious bony swelling, is if these dogs are painful on palpation over the ends of their long bones. Again, looking at common sites, so squeezing the proximal humerus, the distal radius, these are areas that are certainly worthwhile looking at. So, how do we diagnose these? Well, ultimately, diagnosis can be split into imaging diagnosis and biopsy. And we'll talk a little bit about biopsy in a minute, but we'll start by concentrating on imaging. Now, these tend to have a fairly classical radiographic appearance. It's a mixed lytic proliferative lesion. It tends to be in metaphyseal locations. There tends to be a loss of trabecular pattern, and you tend to get a degree of cortical lysis. And in some dogs, you'll get the classical sunburst periosteal reaction, like you can see on the radiograph on the right. But off radiographs alone, you can't be 100% sure that we are dealing with an osteosarcoma, with other bone tumors looking very similar, and some cases of osteomyelitis also looking very similar. So the picture of the bone changes in the proximal ulna on the left radiograph, that's actually an osteomyelitis case. So when we look at these radiographs and we see a bony change like this in the metaphysis of a distal of a long bone, particularly when we see it in the distal radius, one of the very common sites. These are the classical appearance, so you can again see a very mixed lytic proliferative lesion. They're all in metaphyseal locations. There's loss of trabecular pattern. Yeah, again, you've got corticolysis, and occasionally, like the X-ray in the center, you've got a periosteal reaction. It's also worthwhile looking for evidence of a pathological fracture, which certainly you can see in the X-ray on the right. One thing also to look out for is when you've got a dog that presents to you with a low trauma pathological fracture, or a low trauma fracture, always look at the ends of the fracture. Look for periosteal reaction, look for cortical lysis. Does this look like normal healthy bone? Because certainly you don't want to start thinking about fracture repair if you've got an obvious or even a very subtle osteosarcoma. Now, not all of them will have obvious or very obvious pathology, particularly in the early stages, and not all of them are in classical locations. So this dog presented to me with hip pain and presented on the presumption that this dog might have a hip replacement. Now, clearly, when you look at these X-rays, the hips look absolutely normal. But if you look closely, there might just be a suggestion of lysis on the pubis there. And if you look at the lateral X-ray, there might just be a suggestion of mineralization of the soft tissues just ventral to the pelvis. Now, sometimes you can have soft tissues superimposed over the area of interest, or you've got fecal material and gas in the rectum. That can be particularly problematic when you're looking at pictures of the pelvis. And in these cases where you're not sure if there's something there, CT can be really, really helpful in demonstrating these subtle pathology. And you can see off this 3D reconstructed CT image, there's fairly significant changes there. Now, other primary bone tumors can also have a very similar appearance. And chondrosarcomas like this one, these ones here, whilst they can look very similar to osteosarcoma, like the distal humerus on the left and the distal femur on the top central, the vast majority of these tumours tend to have massive soft tissue mineralised components. So the classic chondrosarcoma is the femur in the central bottom slide and the proximal tibia on the far right. But they could all very similarly look like osteosarcoma. Again, these images have very almost classical appearance for an osteosarcoma, particularly the one on the left, that proximal humerus. It's got almost a sunburst periosteal reaction. It's certainly got a degree of lysis and loss of normal trabecular pattern, but that's actually a fibrosarcoma. The one on the right is actually a multiple myeloma. Now, when you're dealing with tumors like chondrosarcomas and fibrosarcomas, these carry a vastly different and much more positive prognosis than osteosarcoma. So radiographs, whilst they give you an idea of what's going on, that they don't not necessarily give you a slam dunk diagnosis. Now, they don't all follow the same classical appearance, and they can also appear in atypical locations. So these two images here are fairly aggressive bony changes in diaphyseal bone. They carry some of the classic appearance of an osteosarcoma, except that they're in diaphyseal bone. Now, it's very unusual to have a primary bone tumor in diaphyseal bone. These tend to be the sites of metastatic spread from a primary tumor elsewhere, simply because the primary tumor, you'll have lodging of these tumor cells near the nutrient foramen in these bones. So if you see a primary tumor like this in the diaphyseal bone, I'd be hunting for a primary tumor elsewhere. Now, some of these lytic lesions, whilst you can't be sure whether they're something nasty or not, they take a very similar appearance to bone cysts. Now, this looks like a univariate bone cyst, something very benign. Unfortunately for this dog, this turned out to be an osteosarcoma. Likewise, when you have marked periosteal change like this, we weren't sure what this was off the radiographs alone, so you can see it's been biopsied. This turned out to be an osteomyelitis, but again, it carries enough similarities with osteosarcoma that it's that you could change what you say to the owner based on the radiographs. So that leads into biopsy. If you've got an idea of what's going on, you've got nasty changes or nasty appearing changes in radiographs or CT, you're not sure if you're dealing with an osteosarcoma, the next step is to do a biopsy. Now, there's a couple of different biopsy options. Really, it's cytology or histology. Now, the cytology options are fine needle aspirate or roll prep. Histology, you can do core needle samples with a jam sheeting needle, a Michel Treffen, or an excisional biopsy sample. Now, just as an aside, if you are doing an amputation for a very aggressive bone lesion, it's always worth sending off the whole limb rather than just a sample, simply because you can send off only a sample which might be necrotic or reactive bone. So this is a bony tumor. Why are we considering doing a fine needle aspirate? Well, these tumors tend to have very thin eggshell cortices, so introducing a biopsy needle into the bone is actually not very difficult, and it's quite feasible for a large number of these. Also, there tends to be quite a large amount of soft tissue extension with these guys, so even if you can't get the needle into the bone itself, there's still a good chance you might get some of that soft tissue component. Now, unlike the classic sarcoma, and this being a mesenchymal tumor, these are highly exfoliative. So even when doing a fine needle aspirate, they tend to shed quite a good number of cells. Now, there's a number of studies that report the diagnosis of a positive diagnosis for a sarcoma through needle aspirate in these guys of between 85 and 95%. So that's fairly good feedback there. Now, large gauge needles may be more helpful and may yield a more diagnostic sample, but to be fair, I tend to use 23 and 21 gauge needles. I won't go any bigger than that, and I'm getting the same sorts of diagnostic results. So about 85 to 95% a diagnosis of sarcoma. Now, if the pathologist also, if you ask for ALP staining, the pathologist can be more certain this is going to be an osteosarcoma and not a fibrosarcoma or a chondrosarcoma. So, a case like this, an extensive soft tissue involvement, a large periosteal reaction, significant bone lesion, a fine needle aspirate would be a pretty reasonable step. But these ominous yellow letters might suggest otherwise. So, one needle, one greyhound, an hour later, crack. Pretty embarrassing. So, this gets to the next point. Whenever you're doing investigations, always remember we're dealing with eggshell thin, mechanically compromised bone. Now, perhaps something as minor as the fine needle aspirate or a biopsy may lead to an explosive release of the intramedullary pressure from that expansile mass, remembering that these start endosteally and tend to grow out. Or perhaps the dog slipped during recovery from sedation. Regardless, always warn the clients of the possibility of the pathological fracture during examination and investigation. Incidentally, when we're looking at pathological fractures in dogs, in people, pardon me, most occur during mundane activities. They don't occur during high-impact sport. So sometimes first time someone knows they've got a problem is when they break their arm or their while they're brushing their teeth or putting on a seatbelt. So more traditional bone biopsy was with Michel Treffens or jam sheeting needles. Now, we probably don't use Michel Treffens anymore. We're probably just using jam sheeting needles. The reason being is the Michel Treffens huge. I get nervous whenever I see one. I'm concerned that I'm going to have a higher risk of causing a pathological fracture. Now, Michel Treffens are really easy to use. You need minimal equipment, and the main tip for doing these is make sure when introducing and when you start pushing down, you get a really good grip of the bone. You don't want this sliding around. Now, what you do is you just do a rotating movement, as you can see on the video, and then you'll feel it pop through the first cortex. Now, that's as far as you need to go. That should give you a pretty decent sample. And usually you don't need to use a huge amount of force, and you can see it just pop through there. One reason I like using these biopsies is it's really super easy to retrieve the core sample. They come with a little stylet, so you can retrograde the stylet up through the needle and gently remove the sample. And this way you're not damaging your sample and increasing your chance of getting a diagnostic sample. So biopsy isn't without potential problems. Now, sure, one of the things you can have is an increased lameness after. You can get seromy, you can get surgical site infections. They tend to resolve. They tend to sort themselves out. I'm more concerned about pathological fracture, and that can occur with very gentle biopsy technique. That can occur with fine needle aspirate, even as alarmingly demonstrated by that case before. And in my mind, larger gauge biopsies, increased number of biopsies probably increases your risk of having something go disastrously wrong. It's also worthwhile remembering that you've got to be careful with these animals during sedation and during their recovery, where the animal might slip or twist. These are the danger times for pathological fracture. Tumor seeding you can get, and it tends only to be a problem if you're considering doing a limb spare, simply because you may have tumor seeding of surrounding tissues, which might limit your ability to remove the entire tumor. If you're planning on doing an amputation, then it's not really a concern. What is concerning is these are not always diagnostic, so you may go through all of that risk all for a non-diagnostic sample. So to maximize your chance of getting a decent sample is aim for the center. With some soft tissue tumors, if you aim for the center, you'll get a necrotic core. You won't get a good sample. It's not the case with osteosarcomas. If you go for the margins of the tumor, you're more likely to get reactive bone. The best place and the most diagnostic place to get a sample is right in the center, not where this biopsy is being taken. Now, if you get a sample of necrotic bone, or you get a sample of reactive bone, that does not mean benign disease. What it means is you've probably not got a representative sample. So, with all these risks, do you actually need to do a biopsy? Now, we can usually be pretty certain of a primary bone tumor off radiographs plus or minus CT. So, with all of those potential risks, do we need to do it? Well, to be fair, it depends. If surgical treatment is not going to be altered by the outcome of the biopsy, for example, you've got a dog that presents with a pathological fracture, or there's such extensive bone loss or destruction that it precludes doing a salvage option, then there is an argument to push on with staging and surgery. However, if you do remove the tumor at surgery, via an amputation, then you've got to send it off simply because what it is will very much influence treatment like chemo, and certainly give you an idea of what sort of prognosis the animal has. So now you've got a diagnosis. What do you do? Well, treatment ultimately depends on several factors. You've got all of these treatment options from palliative to straightforward surgical amputation and chemotherapy, limb spare. Now, treatment will ultimately depend on client factors. So, what sort of expectations they've got, what financial resources they've got, what sort of client they are, whether they're a very enthusiastic, very motivated client. You've got lots of patient factors, whether the dog's got significant comorbidities, and also whether the dog's got any prognostic indicators or factors that might negatively influence survival time. For example, if you're considering doing a limb spare, this is not really op an option if your life expectancy is going to be lower than the expected recovery time from any surgery. So, what factors are associated with low survival times? The location of the tumor, the amount of ALK Phos, the grade of tumor, the stage of tumor, and the age. Now, age is a bit of an anecdotal, is probably anecdotal. There's not a huge amount of evidence, but when you talk to other surgeons, all the young dogs we see tend to have a much higher grade tumor, and they tend to present more with gross evidence of metastatic disease. Now, as well as that tombstone being a bit grim, this slide's to remind me, just to acknowledge Professor Nick Bacon for providing some of these slides today. So we're going to talk a little bit now about the factors associated with low survival times, and we'll start with location first. So the proximal humerus, and to be fair, proximal femur, and tumors that are closer to the body tend to have a poorer prognosis than the distal radius. Now, whilst the location being closer may mean that seeding of the tumor to the body is easier, another potential cause is the proximal humerus has a much larger bone volume than the distal radius, and it may simply be that we have a larger tumor volume to bone ratio at the time of diagnosis, which means we may be finding the humeral lesions later. Perhaps we pick up radial tumors earlier as we've got a smaller bone and we've got less soft tissue surrounding them. Regardless, If the tumour is close to the body, if we've got a proximal humour or proximal femoral tumour, these tend to be bad news and we'll have a lower expected survival time. ALK-FOS is another interesting thing. So there's numerous studies showing elevated ALK-FOS at the time of diagnosis is significantly associated with lower survival times. Now, this is regardless of what treatment they have. So the first few studies showed a factor of almost a little over 2, and that's been replicated in further studies where elevated ALK-FOS means the dog's unlikely to survive particularly long. And so you'd probably be really considering whether or not you're going to be doing any major or advanced surgeries with these guys. Now, when we look at tumor grading, we look at the cellular pleomorphism, we look at how many mitotic figures we have, we look at the cellularity and the percentage necrosis. Now, extraordinarily, around 75% of these tumors are grade 3, so only a small number of them are grade 1 to 2. Now, again, if you've got a very high grade tumor, the likelihood of these having spread is very high, and unfortunately the survival time with these guys is also quite low. Now, although we expect almost all dogs to have metastatic disease in some way, shape or form, the presence of detectable mets does negatively influence survival time. And unfortunately, chemotherapy seems to be ineffective at improving this. Now, with one study, the median survival time of these stage 3 dogs was only around 76 days. But interestingly, when we look closer at the data, dogs with metastatic spread to the bones survive considerably longer than those with soft tissue spread, which typically goes to the lungs. Regardless, it's still only 139 days, and these were all dogs receiving chemotherapy. And so generally, if you've got stage 3 disease, regardless of if it's soft tissue or bone, it's bad news. So because the most common site of metastatic spread is to the lungs, three-view thoracic radiographs should be performed at a minimum. And on this slide, you can see that central nodule there. And however, the size threshold for nodule detection with chest CTs is only 7 to 9 millimeters, so you can miss much smaller tumors. The way around that is CT, which is much more accurate than x-rays, and it has a significantly lower size threshold for nodule detection of around 1 millimeter. Now, this is opposed to the 7 to 9 millimetres that we see for x-rays. Now, regardless of the improved ability to detect metastatic disease, it's still only reported to be found in about 10% of cases. So, again, we expect micrometastatic spread in 90 to 98%, but we'll still pick up, we can still only pick up about 10% on advanced imaging. And you can see these nodules on the left slide, the transverse section in the lung fields on the left, the two dorsal lung nodules, and again you can see a caudal lung nodule on the caudal transverse section on the right. Now, we know around 8% of these will spread to other bones, and these studies were done off scintigraphy, which in one study showed an alarming 8%. Now, you can see the uptake of technetium on the scan on the right. You see that big hyperintensity and the distal left antebrachium. You can also see an area of hyperintensity in one of the caudal ribs on the image on the right. Now, scintigraphy isn't readily available, and so it's not for everyone, but it's certainly worth remembering that 8% will spread to other bones, so that's quite a large number of cases. So, advanced diagnostics aside, a complete orthopedic examination is an essential and powerful tool for picking these up. So, this is a dog that presented to us with a pathological fracture of the right radius. Now, during an orthopedic examination, the dog also was painful on the distal left antebrachium. So this poor dog had synchronous bilateral distal radial tumors. Now, granted, the changes on the left are much more subtle, but they're there. There's distinct loss of trabecular pattern, there's cortical lysis, and you're just starting to see a degree of periosteal reaction as well. Now, this emphasizes why it's important to do a complete physical exam. Clearly, this dog's not going to be a candidate for an amputation given the presence of what's going on the left. So, having a very complete discussion with the owner, including euthanasia, is really important. In dogs where no other abnormalities are noted on physical exam, given that we know around 8% will spread to other bones, survey radiographs and whole body CT can be considered. It's not necessary. To be fair, what I'll do is I'll start with simply a physical exam. If we are going to take the dog to surgery, either a limb spur or an amputation, then we will do further x-rays. Now, interestingly, only 4% actually go to local lymph nodes. Now, this always surprised me because when you take a limb off, the lymph nodes are always huge. So when we send these lymph nodes off, the vast majority of them come back as reactive lymph nodes. So that always surprised me. As a result, I tend not to do lymph node aspirates before surgery simply because the vast majority are not really productive and come back as a reactive node. However, if you do get a positive diagnosis and you've got positive spread to the lymph nodes, this is usually associated with low survival times, and again, that's regardless of treatment. So certainly it's something to take off if you're removing a leg, send the lymph node off because that will drastically alter your prognosis. Fine needle aspirates don't tend to be that useful. So again, we take a step back. We expect micrometastatic disease in 98 to 90%, so we know this is going to be a life-limiting disease for the vast majority. But if we can pick up detectable metastatic disease, so to the lungs, other bones, and sometimes lymph nodes, we know that's going to alter our short-term prognosis at least, and that's significantly going to alter our survival times and will influence our treatment options. So back to treatment. We've got palliative options, we've got surgical options, and we'll talk a little bit about palliative options first. So, to be fair, palliative options are the usual suspects with pain relief. We start off with non-steroidals. You can use tramadol. You tend to use fairly high-dose tramadol. Gabapentin can be useful. Now, ultimately, the endpoint for these dogs is almost always euthanasia due to either uncontrolled pain or pathological fracture, and making sure your clients are educated on that's going to be the way the dog goes is very important. Some clients don't want to go down that pathway, and will elect to euthanize at the start, so it's worthwhile having that discussion from the beginning. The median survival time for these dogs is around about 3 months. Now, the fourth drug on there, zoledronate, is a bisphosphonate, and again, it's worthwhile having a chat about these. So these are osteoclast inhibitors. They decrease osteolysis and may provide analgesia via reduced microcracking of this mechanically compromised bone. The oral doses of alendronate are significantly less bioavailable than the injectables, where zoledronate is 10 times more bioavailable than pimidronate, which is again 10 times more bioavailable than alendronate. So the best injectable zoledronate is 100 times more bioavailable than alendronate, and certainly we don't tend to use alendronate anymore. These are starting to gain a bit more traction, and certainly we'll use these quite frequently. Simply, you do get a good degree of pain relief for a number of these dogs, and the side effects tend to be relatively low grade. Amputation alone can also be a good palliative option. It can provide really good analgesia, and certainly it's an option for dogs that present with pathological fracture. Now, it's tolerated very well across the breeds, even in large breed dogs. Now, traditionally, it used to be thought giant breed dogs and large breed dogs struggled with amputation, especially thoracic limb amputation. In my experience, these guys do brilliantly. What you need is a very motivated dog and a very motivated client, and often these dogs will be up the next day. So even in dogs with no detectable metastatic disease, we expect these dogs will have micrometastatic disease. So amputation alone is a palliative option. And again, we expect median survival times of around 3 months. Again, it's highly unlikely to be curative. And to be fair, it's something that we'll consider doing in dogs with stage three if pushed, and if the dog's really painful, but it's not really an option given the very low survival times with those dogs. So when you do an amputation, the addition to chemotherapy to amputation will increase the median survival time of these dogs up to 10 to 12 months, where there's no evidence of gross metastatic disease. Now, there's lots of different protocols for chemotherapy, as this slide demonstrates, and we're not going to go too far into them, but we tend to use 6 cycles of carboplatin and expect a median survival time of 10 to 12 months. Now, whilst chemo significantly increases survival times, there are circumstances that might dictate amputation only, and these can include client and patient factors. Now, with regards to client factors, chemo is generally quite expensive, and given this is a disease predominantly in giant breed dogs, it can get very expensive and can be cost prohibitive for some clients. With patient factors, if you've got a pregnant or a nursing dog, this might preclude chemo. And we've had some cases where the client wanted the dog to take the puppy's term and declined chemotherapy. If the dog's urinary incontinent, you may not be able to do chemo, or the dog might need prolonged hospitalization. Simply, if you're having chemo and you're leaking cytotoxic urine, this is not ideal, and it's certainly not an option if the dog's going to be doing that at home. So where do I cut with an amputation? There's loads of options, from the mid-shaft option to the high disarticulation or four-quarter amputation, and each have their pros and cons. To be fair, I'll almost always do either a four-quarter amputation or a hip disarticulation. It's a little bit longer a surgery. It looks a little bit more shocking to clients initially, but I find these dogs have better, they look a little bit better long term. And subjectively, I don't think you get quite as many long-term complications, where they might get pain at the end of the amputation stump, and they may. So each option is absolutely fine to do, but to be fair, I'll usually do a high amputation. So giant breed dogs don't do well with amputation. Giant breed dogs don't do well with a thoracic limb amputation. That's not been my experience, and certainly that's not the experience at our clinic. This is dog 24 hours after surgery. Again, these dogs tend to be highly motivated. They're often a lot more comfortable the day after surgery, particularly if you've removed a limb with a pathological fracture, or a limb with a very aggressive osteosarcoma, where there's a lot of change there. I'll always discuss the possibility of the dog not getting up with the client, and advise them, look, the more motivated the dogs are, they just tend to get on with life. They just tend to get up. Now, Not every dog will, but it's certainly it's a giant breed dog doesn't faze me when considering an amputation. What will faze me is if the dog's got a concurrent orthopedic disease or it's got a neurological disease, which might make the dog getting up very, very difficult. So amputation, in cases like that, sometimes we can consider doing a limb spare. Sometimes it's not all over for these poor dogs. Now, there's a couple of limb spare options, but ultimately it has no impact on survival time when compared with amputation. Now, when we do an amputation alone without chemo, we expect around 3 months as a median survival time. So, with amputation, again, like with a limb spare, we'd expect a median survival time of 10 to 12 months. So it's effectively the same as same survival times as an amputation and chemo. And as a general rule, we wouldn't do a limb spare unless the client was happy and able to go ahead with chemo afterwards. Now, as a general rule, limb spare can be done at any site where arthrodesis can be performed. And hence, the distal limb tends to have a better outcome. It tends to be less viable at sites where function after arthrodesis is poor. Now, that's the traditional approach. We're starting to have custom endoprostheses and joint replacements available. So it's a watch this space, but at the moment, limb spare tends to be limited to distal limbs. Now, this is a video of a dog very shortly after transtumoral plating and stereotactic radiotherapy. So you can see it's got reasonable function on the right thoracic limb. You can see it can't flex its carpus, but this is only a couple of months after limb spare surgery. So function's very good for this dog. So there's always some exceptions to rules, but generally our selection criteria for long bone limb spare are as follows. The tumor has to affect less than 50% of the bone length, simply because if it affects more of the bone length, there's going to be less room for an endoprosthesis, and that endoprosthesis will be under a lot more mechanical stress and strain. So if it's smaller than 50% bone length, we'll consider it. Now, you can't always get an idea of how much endosteal spread there is from X-rays alone, so almost all our limb spares will have CT to track that endosteal involvement. In general, the tumor can't cross the joint. Now, that's generally not a problem for osteosarcoma. It tends not to involve any joint or cross a joint. Ideally, these have minimal soft tissue involvement. If they've got extensive spread and extensive involvement, we may not be able to completely remove the tumor. And if that's the case, then controlling local disease won't be possible, and we won't consider doing them. We won't do them where we've got a catastrophic pathological fracture. Simply, again, these tend to have significant soft tissue involvement, so complete excision and removal is not possible. Likewise, most endoprostheses are now custom built or need to be ordered in, and having a dog with a or managing a dog with a pathological fracture whilst we wait for the implants is not particularly kind. Again, because of the significantly lower expected lifespan with dogs with gross metastatic disease, we're not going to do them in general where a dog has clear evidence of metastatic spread. Simply, the survival time versus recovery from surgical time isn't worth it for the dog. So, limb spare can be indicated in any patient that fits those clinical selection criteria. And dogs with orthopedic and neuro disease that might preclude an amputation, maybe even more so. Likewise, these can be a pretty decent option for clients that are unwilling to amputate. However, these are expensive. The clients need to have the financial means not just for the surgery, but also for chemotherapy afterwards. We do not offer this as an option if the clients are unwilling from the outset to go through with chemo. And again, with this being predominantly giant and large breed dogs, then unfortunately, chemo can be quite expensive. These also have to be the right sort of client, as you'll find out, these cases can be long, drawn-out cases, particularly if there's complications. And the client has to be on board for the journey. So you can't have a fickle client and a client that the clients have to have reasonable expectations. So once we've selected our patients for limb spare, basically the options include surgical removal of the tumor, which can be an option in some cases, and variable endoprostheses. You can use vascularized cortical autografts or allografts in some circumstances, but these are tending to lose favor. You can use percutaneous fixation to the skeleton or the perfits. This is essentially a distal limb prosthesis, so removal of the distal limb and application of an ingrowth prosthesis. And we're just starting to see stereotactic radiotherapy as an option. So when we look at removal of the tumor, there's some bones that are highly amenable to this. You can have excellent function in some cases with a distal ulnar tumor, simply removing the tumor. Assessment of carpal stability afterwards is very important, and occasionally we'll need to do a pan combine this with a pancarpal arthrodesis, but function afterwards can be excellent. Likewise, with the scapula, if you have you can remove up to 2 to 3 up to 2/3 of the dorsal segment of the scapula, and animals can still have very good outcomes. So it's something that we'll consider doing, partial scapulectomies. Other long bones tend to be more significantly important for mechanics of the limbs, so it tends to be not an option simply removing the tumor. There are variable endoprostheses that you can do. Essentially, this involves removal of the tumor en bloc. You need to make sure all the endosteal tumor is removed. You need to remove the soft tissue envelope around the tumor. So planning these with CT is absolutely important. Now, traditionally, what used to be done is we used to replace the removed bone with a metallic spacer and do a concurrent arthrodesis of the joint adjacent to the endoprostheses. That metallic spacer, there's been some trials using cortical allografts. Again, there's pros and cons to doing that, and they're probably losing favor. Now, sadly, complications following limb spare are not uncommon, with many probably due to the early design flaws of these implants. So we used to see peri-implant fracture. We used to see implant failures, either plate failure or screw failure. Particularly screw loosening was quite common in early models. Now, these are probably less of a problem now we've had the introduction of new generation endoprostheses with locking screws and with titanium or tantalum or even hypoxia-apatite coated ends to encourage bone on growth. So the newer generations tend to be mechanically better. And so the endoprostheses we're using here tends to have a modular design. So it's highly adaptable. It's got a dual radius ulna and dual metacarpal plates, so it's highly robust. And unlike the traditional metal spaces, these spaces are coated with hypoxia-apatite to encourage bone on growth. And again, unlike the traditional plates, these use locking screws. So we've looked at the design flaws of the previous implants and we've come up with this. And we're having pretty decent results. So we're seeing fewer and fewer mechanical failure complications in these dogs. Now, in the dogs that are lucky enough to survive a long time, so in those cases when we may have caught the disease before micrometastatic spread, or even in cases where they've got a less aggressive tumor, like a fibrosarcoma or chondrosarcoma, these implants are starting to last, or designed now, hopefully, to last the lifetime of the dog. So in these radiographs, we've got follow-up at 1, 2, and 3 years. And then at the 3-year CT, you can see that there's still osteointegration with the implant. So we'd expect the dog to fail before these implants fail, which is good news. Now, traditional design had high infection rates in the region of around 50%. Now, that's not unsurprising when we consider the following factors. These tumors need extensive surgical resection. You're replacing it either with non-viable cortical bone, a large metallic implant, and if you're using a non-viable cortical allograft, sometimes we'll have infused the marrow cavity with bone cement. So you've got a large amount of foreign material in there. There's a paucity of soft tissues to supply sufficient vascular supply to these surgical sites. So we've got a recipe here for infection. Also, it's not unusual for these dogs to probably have some altered sensation over their distal limb. So some of these dogs will self-traumatize. Now, to add to that, these dogs are all getting adjunctive chemotherapy, so their immune systems aren't going to be functioning normally anyway. So these are high infection candidates, and we saw up to 50%, which is enormous. Now, whilst the newer designs and the better mechanics may lead to a lower infection rate, infections are still a massive problem. Now, very interestingly, infected limb spares have a longer survival time. And this has been shown in people, it's been shown in multiple studies in dogs. Now, this may be due to tumor suppression from the infection, and there's a lot of research going on into that, but this is a two-edged sword. These animals might live longer, but you've got to manage a chronic infection, which means these patients are continually visiting the clinic. Often they'll have something horrible and resistant. You'll need to barrier them every time they come in. There'll be the additional cost of antibiotics to these clients. There'll be a degree of morbidity associated with these infections. So whilst they might live a bit longer, these aren't particularly happy cases. They can be pretty miserable to deal with. But function afterwards can be excellent. And this is a dog a day after a distal limb spare. And we're already up and about using the limb spare. So much the same as a dog that's had a pancarpal arthrodesis. It's up and about. It's using the leg. So function afterwards is certainly worth the risk for a large number of these dogs. Now, this is an elderly Rottweiler that has horrible hip dysplasia. It's got significant elbow disease on the left elbow and had a right distal limb spare. Now, you can see his pelvic limbs aren't particularly great. He's kind of waddling around. But this dog, there's no way in the world this dog would have done with an amputation. So this is a case we've got a dog that won't do with amputation. Its clinical factors are all fine for a limb spare, and you've got a highly motivated owner who wants to get on. Now, function again can be excellent. So this is Harry. He's finished his chemotherapy. His hair's grown back. He's walking brilliantly. So this dog's had a thoracic limb spare. He's walking as you'd expect most of your pancarpal arthrodesis should be walking. And whilst there's that very subtle gait change, he looks brilliant. So this is a case where 4 legs good, 3 legs bad. These dogs can have excellent function if you're willing to go ahead with the risks. So the next step with management of these guys is radiation therapy. Now, radiation really can be divided into palliative and therapeutic. Now, we'll firstly talk about palliative radiotherapy. It's an external beam. It's pretty crude. So this is an image of a port film showing the target area. You can see you're not being particularly precise. That area, that black square, is the area that's going to cop the radiation dose. So you can see a lot of the soft tissues around are going to cop a fairly heavy dose as well. So it's not curative intent, it's not really targeted or focused, but we do this in certain cases to try and shrink tumor volume and reduce the pain from that expansile mass. So we'll do usually 2 to 3 of these doses, and it's something that we're starting to err away. It's something that we'll only consider in some cases, but it's pretty crude. The future of radiotherapy is probably stereotactic radiosurgery, and this is the delivery of small beamlets of overlapping radiation. Now, radiation is cumulative, so overlapping areas get an increased dosage. So with the image on the left, you can see 9 beamlets converging on the tumor. So the tumor itself, the area around the tumor gets a very tiny dose, and the target area gets a large dose. It gets that concentration of all those beams. The beamlets are also transmitted in an arc, which means you can get almost an infinite number of overlapping beamlets at the target site. Now, one of the ways to imagine how this works is if you consider a bouquet of flowers. The stems at the base have the highest density, which in this term means the base gets the highest dose. The bunch of flowers around the periphery is much less dense, so there's much less of a dosage. So this is an image of our planning for stereotactic radiotherapy, and these are what we call iscedence lines. These are like contour lines on a map. Now, the closer the lines are together, the faster the decline or the drop-off in dose. So what this means is we can go from 100% dose rate over the target zone to about a 50% dose reduction in 2 to 3 millimeters. So that means we can normally stay below the skin, and thus avoid radiation burns to our collateral peripheral tissue. Now, because we're irradiating and killing off this bone and the bone tumor, we've got a dead piece of bone in there. So at a later stage, almost all of these dogs will need to have transtumoral plating, which means we need to put a bone plate over them to stabilize them to stop them catastrophically failing. We tend not to do them the same day as the radiation dose, simply because the skin's very compromised. We do surgery then. It will probably all fall apart, so we tend to wait a little bit. Whilst this is probably the future as far as where we go, there's still a very high infection rate simply because you're creating a very large piece of dead bone, and then putting a plate on it. So, unfortunately, like all limb spares, these do still have a high infection rate, but it's certainly a very good option. So this is a lucky case, but it demonstrates what sort of function is possible. So the tumor has been nuked. This is a dog from Florida. The tumor's had stereotactic radiotherapy. It's been nuked. And then a plate's been applied over the top. So this has been combined with a pancarpal arthrodesis. Now, whilst there's a degree of circumduction of the limb, function is excellent. So this is another case of 4 legs, excellent. 3 legs probably would have done okay with an amputation, but you can see the dog's very, very functional there. Now, these videos and images from stereotactic radiotherapy, they were taken from Florida, where this is available. Unfortunately, it's not currently available in the UK, but we've got a bunker built at Guildford Hospital, and we're in the process of negotiating the purchase of one of these, and we're hoping to have this as a treatment option available within the next 12 months. So it's a watch this space. So finally, look, with osteosarcoma, there are loads of potential treatment options, and when we choose a plan, we need to tailor it to the animal. We need to remember the biological behavior of these tumors. We need to consider the patient's health, any significant comorbidities. We also need to consider the owner perceptions and expectations. So this is a flow chart that sort of summarizes most of my decision making when I have a bone tumor walk through the door. Again, this is a highly aggressive tumor where we expect most have already metastasized. So whilst we've got all these options available and function after these options can be excellent, you've always got to discuss euthanasia from the very beginning, just so we've got the client on board, we've got reasonable expectations, and everyone can be happy with the final treatment choice. Thank you. So there's a couple of questions. Why does ALP increase with osteosarcoma? It is a good sign if it's not elevated. It increases with osteosarcoma simply because you've got a higher turnover of bone, because you've got a lot of osteolysis happening. It's not a good sign if it's elevated, simply because these tend to be associated with higher grade tumors, and certainly it's associated with lower survival time. So it is a better sign if there's low or normal ALK phos. Bad sign if it's not. So the next question is, how long is the average treatment time for chemo? We tend to spread treatment every 4 to 6 weeks. Treatment time generally lasts 3 to 6 months. But again, it depends on which protocol you're using. Okay, so what would I do after 4 chemo sessions with carboplatin, and an X-ray was taken? There was an increase in thoracic metastatic disease. Or I guess what this is trying to say, if an X-ray was taken and I could see thoracic mets. Sadly, I mean, this is a very good question, and I would probably still stick with the final 2 sessions of carboplatin, but I'd be talking to the client and saying, look, we've already got evidence of spread. The likelihood is our survival time is going to be much lower, and have a chat with them. Sometimes these clients will say, look, actually, we've got thoracic spread. Let's stop the chemo and let's call it a day. It's a difficult one simply because whilst we know gross metastatic disease, the chemo with the studies that we've got shows no evidence of it tends to be ineffective. It may have some effect. It's a difficult question, but talking to the surgical oncologists and the medical oncologists that usually tell me to keep going, it might have a positive influence. But ultimately, it's a time where you need to sit down with the client and go through the images and say, look, I'm really sorry, but we've got spread. And do you still want me to continue? So very, very good question. It's not an easy answer, I'm afraid.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.